All right, and we are live. Welcome, everyone. This is our monthly advisor Q&A with Wealthion's endorsed financial advisors. I, of course, am Adam Taggart, founder of Wealthion, welcoming you all here for this month's live Q&A with our advisors. It comes at a very timely time because yesterday, which was September 13th, 2022, we saw the worst one-day drop in the markets since, I believe, June of 2020, when the world obviously was in a panic mode around the pandemic. So really violent drop yesterday, S&P down 4%, NASDAQ down 5%. What's most likely to happen from here? That's one of the key questions we're going to be asking our advisors today. We are joined by, and let me bring everybody up here, I'm joined by the lead partners from New Harbor Financial. That's Mike Preston and John Lodra. We are joined this month by Mike Leibowitz, again, coming from Real Investment Advisors. His co-partner, Lance Roberts, also usually joins these, but Lance was out today and Michael very kindly stepped in. I call that an upgrade. Folks, the format here is that this is a live chat. These monthly advisor Q&As are to address any and all questions that you folks have. So use the live chat function here to ask your questions, and I will do my best to pick out as many as I can and ask our advisor partners here. If you can't watch the whole thing, don't worry. It will instantly, once we're done here, be a replay video up on YouTube, same URL. So you can come back, you can watch the whole thing. And if you're watching this on replay, welcome. Last, just before we dive right in, I want to remind folks that the Wealthion Fall Online Conference is coming up fast. It's just a week and a half away at this point. If you haven't registered for it yet, do so now. And the reason why you want to do so now is because we have a remaining last chance to save price discount of 15%. And I want to make sure as many people get that as possible before it expires this Saturday at midnight. So to go learn more about the conference and to register and claim that discount, just go to wealthion.com/conference. All right, let's get on to the Q&A now. John, Mike, and Mike. Guys, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Adam. Good to be here. Great.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be with you all. Adam and Michael, good to see you.
All right. Well, guys, why don't we start with the question that I asked everybody or that I mentioned here in my intro, which is, hey, the markets just had their biggest one-day drop in 2 years, over 2 years yesterday. How are you guys reacting to that? And what do you think that calls for going forward? Let's see. Mike Leibowitz, why don't we start with you?
Sure. I think, first of all, let's just put it into perspective. All it did was get back to Monday, Tuesday levels from the week prior. But I think the bigger message from it is more that volatility is alive and well. I know a lot of people follow the VIX and other volatility indicators, and they've been high but stable. They're not warning of potential problems. But I think what we saw late last week, early this week, and then on Tuesday's CPI report is that there's a disconnect between what the market thinks of inflation and what the market thinks the Fed is going to do and what the Fed is saying they're going to do and what may likely happen with inflation. And market expectations are that inflation is going to start falling rapidly. And with it, the Fed's going to do what they usually do and flip back to easy mode, start lowering rates and try to protect the economy, the stock market, and kind of following the path that they have traditionally followed for the last 30 years. I think the risk that's not being priced is that inflation is too sticky, meaning that it comes down really slowly and that it doesn't come down to 2%, which is where the Fed wants it, that it comes down to 4%, 5%, 6% and gets stuck there. And that's a big risk. And I think the other risk is they're underestimating the Fed. For the first time in my career, I really feel like the Fed will do, or certainly acting like they're going to do what it takes to make sure inflation does not become a decade-long problem. They learned a lot of lessons from Volcker in the 1970s, 80s, and they're paying close attention to a lot of the things that happened you know, in those times and is occurring today. And I think there's the potential risk is that the market is not fully on board with what the Fed's doing, not priced for what the Fed's doing. And when that happens, you end up with big days like we saw yesterday. You get some potential rallies, but the risks are still pretty large.
All right. So you're basically saying, which we've been debating, I've been debating with a lot of the advisors here on the call here over the many weeks, recent weeks on this channel, is that the Fed, the Powell especially, has been saying, hey, folks, we're really serious about doing whatever it takes here. And the market has been saying, we're not really sure. You know, we think you're kind of over-exaggerating it and you're going to pivot soon. Then obviously when the July CPI came down a bit, the markets thought, oh, hey, you know, looks like the Fed's getting inflation under control. It may be able to stop the rate hikes sooner. And Powell had to come back in Jackson Hole and say, hey, folks, that's not the case. Market began cooling off. And then we had the still quite hot CPI print yesterday. And I think the market said, dear God, I think Powell's actually right. And that pain, and that was actually words that Jerome Powell used, that pain, he's serious about this time.
Right. And, you know, I think what's important is not some of those warnings from Powell, but some of the other things he says about his understanding of 70s, 80s inflation. And the difference between that inflation and what we've seen and little outbursts of inflation since the 80s is that the outbursts of inflation were one or two items that drove the inflation rate that were transitory in nature, whether due to specific events or really short-term factors that drove them higher. What happened in the 70s and 80s was a change in behaviors from consumers, from corporations. Consumers, workers demanded wages. So, you know, what we ended up with was a price wage spiral. And when it becomes part of your behavior, when you think about inflation, when you change your consumption habits, or when corporations change their investment habits or the way they come to market with certain goods or the prices, that's when inflation can get ground in, when it can get stuck. And the problem with our economy, and we've talked about this before, is that we cannot afford 5-7% inflation given the amount of debt that we have on our books. I take that back. We can afford the inflation. We can't afford the interest rates that follow that type of inflation that will literally bankrupt the country, corporations, and consumers. I mean, you're already seeing 7% mortgages. So, you know, Powell, I think, feels like he has a choice. He has to stop this and stop it now before our behaviors and corporate behaviors really start changing. And when you read his speeches and kind of read between the lines, he alludes a lot to the 70s and 80s. And I think it's best that we kind of follow closely what happened in the 70s and 80s and how it's different and the same as today.
All right, great. Okay, I'm going to come to the New Harbor guys here. I'm going to let you add on to what Michael said. And I want to just show this related question here. Let's see here. Am I able to get this done? There we go. Dirt Elf asked the question. I just watched an interview with Danielle DiMartino Booth. She poses that Powell is trying to kill the Fed put. Opinion? So I think to a certain extent, that's what Michael Leibowitz has just said, which is the Fed is trying to get people to give up on the fact that the Fed is going to backstop everything and be Santa Claus every time, you know, there's a little wiggle here. Powell is saying, I'm going to do what it takes to get this inflation under control, and you all better believe me. Why don't we start with you, John, then we'll go to you, Mike Preston. Thoughts on yesterday, Michael's comments on the Fed, and wrap in your response to Dirt Elf here, if you can.
Yes, Adam, I want to compliment Michael on his comments there. We very much see the same kinds of things. Yeah, the market hasn't been pricing in the extent and the seriousness of the Fed and its resolve, necessary resolve, to take this inflation impulse quite seriously. So, you know, I think very, you know, the words like Powell used a few weeks back, that we're going to need to feel some pain. I think that it was a very intentional choice of words, because what we have done over the last decade or so, decade or more, has built in a psychological comfort blanket for investors that the Fed is going to have their back and not let markets decline. I think they're now saying that we have to not be there to save markets, because they've gotten this inflation has gotten uncontained. And I think it's very much akin to saying, don't trust that we have your backs. Don't trust that the Fed put that you have been able to rely upon reliably over the last decade is going to be there, or at least not at the levels you think it is. It's going to be a lot lower than where it is or where it has been, provided that the inflation is still a problem. And once they solve that, yeah, I have no doubts that they're going to, you know, go back to trying to save markets, because that's the psychological tool they've chosen to use to make people feel good and comfy and confident. But until they solve this real world issue and get that under control, I think that Fed put is far lower. And for folks that are watching that don't know what a put is, it's basically a line in the sand that the market has implied or assumed the Fed would come in and rescue markets. I think that is very much on shaky ground. And I agree a lot with what Michael Leibowitz said.
All right, good answer. All right, Mike Preston, let's head to you here.
I agree pretty much with everything that's just been said. The Fed put is likely much lower than where it is right now. And in response to Danielle DiMartino, if she thinks that the Fed is, you know, wants to remove the psychological aspect of the Fed put, well, given the fact that markets are still at historically extreme valuations here, coupled with the fact that corporate profit margins are at extreme high levels and likely to revert down, which will put further pressure on valuations, the Fed put is likely much, much lower than here. We have yet to take out the June lows in the S&P around 3,600. The S&P is only 17.5% off of its all-time high. And market cap to GDP and other valuations are still in the stratosphere. So the real risk here, you know, yesterday was a big down day, one day down day, as you said, Adam, the worst since I think 2020. The real risk here is that we have some follow through. We haven't seen any follow through yet in this market for a long time. It's been volatile, but it's been more of a 1 day, 2 day, 3 day phenomenon. There's been very little follow through to the downside, other than it's been a pretty clear downtrend overall with lots of intraday volatility since the January high in the S&P. The real risk here is that we start to have some follow through to the downside and then perhaps take out those June lows. If that happens, I think we see a pretty quick trip down to around 3,200 on the S&P. So, which by the way would still be, by today's calculations, a very egregiously overvalued market. So, lots of risk here. The Fed seems serious. Yes, the market still doesn't seem to believe it. And if Danielle DiMartino Booth is right, then we should see follow through at some point here and a quick trip down to the low 3,000s, maybe 3,200, 3,400 on the S&P.
Okay. I think you just caught a bunch of people's attention there with predicting potentially an S&P that low. But as we've talked about many times in the past, there's lots of reasons to expect why it could go there. All right. Constantine asked this question that a lot of other people are asking variants of. Michael Leibowitz, I'm coming to you here in a second, which is, are we heading for a liquidity crisis? And I want to bring in another question here, this one from Scott, because this ties to something that you mentioned in your earlier answer, Mike Leibowitz. Can the Fed raise interest rates enough to quell inflation? I don't think the U.S. can afford the interest payments on the massive debt if interest rates get anywhere near 8%. I think there are people that are saying that the interest payments on the debt become problematic a lot sooner than 8% as well. And that's one big difference between the Volcker days, is the amount of outstanding federal debt alone is just massively different this time versus it was in Volcker's era. So do we get to a point relatively soon here, Michael, where there's a general liquidity crisis, which is what I think most people refer to when they say the Fed's going to hike until it, quote, breaks something. But how important do you think the interest on the federal debt is going to be as a limiter here?
It's a huge limiter. Scott's question, I think, if you really think about it, helps get into Powell's mindset. Powell knows that we can't have interest rates up at 6%, 7%, 8% and be there for a while. Interest rates can go to 6% for a month, for 2 months, and then come back down. And that will not have a big enough effect on the federal debt to matter. But what the Fed's concerned about is, again, persistent inflation. That's 4%, 5%, 6%, 7%, whatever it may be, and interest rates that follow that path. So I think if you're Powell, if I was Powell, I would have done 50 basis points last week between meetings and then come back with another 50 basis points at the meeting next week. And I would have pushed harder and faster than what the Fed did, because part of the problem is it takes 6 to 9 months to 12 months for the Fed, for interest rates to feed through to the economy. And so what the Fed started doing early this year is just starting to affect the economy for the most part. So when we talk about the Fed going possibly 75 basis points next week, that's not going to show up until March, April, May of next year. So I think when you kind of look at Scott's question, Powell has to understand that, and Powell has to realize that above all else, he has to fight inflation and he has to bring inflation down, or he is going to have some massive crises on his hands. Now, regarding the first question, yes, I think something's going to break. I think the Fed will try their best to kind of maintain this very hawkish stance, but paper over as best they can any kind of crisis. I also am very concerned that a crisis may not happen here. This may be in Europe. Keep in mind, the dollar is flying, and with it, the euro, the yen, other currencies are dropping pretty quickly. So whatever inflation problems we have, theirs are worse because they're dealing with a weakening currency versus the U.S. dollar. And in Europe, they're also dealing with the consequences of the whole Russian-Ukrainian invasion. So, when I think about where's the potential crisis, I think it's with Europe. Maybe it's with Spain, Italy again. Maybe it's that the currency just gets out of control. And my article that I published today talks about this thing, and it's the potential for the Fed to open U.S. swap lines with the central banks of other currencies, which is a way to support their currencies to stop the dollar from appreciating as quickly as it is, and essentially bailing them out, but he can still maintain a very hawkish stance by doing it. So, I think those are both great questions and things that many investors should be thinking about.
All right. So there's two questions that come out of that. One is, and they're big questions. So if the Fed breaks something, then does it revert to QE, right? And we've had a lot of people on this channel in the past say, yeah, probably does, and some say in it you might see the QE that it has to return to as dwarfing anything that we've seen today, right? The Fed ends up creating tightening and until it creates a too big recession, and then it's got to come back and try to undo it all as quickly as it can. So there's that question. And then maybe the other one I want to tackle first. So Michael, I'll ask you the second question, then the New Harbor guys will come to you, which is if the crisis really does happen elsewhere, which it's more likely to, because as you just said, Michael, the other players are suffering more than the US right now. Could that actually strengthen markets in the U.S. as foreign capital flies here? Now, we've already seen that in the dollar a bit, but could that actually prop up markets because we are indeed the last or the least dirty shirt in the hamper, globally?
It could prop up some markets. It could certainly prop up the very short-term bond markets, to some degree, the bond markets, the U.S. dollar. But some of it depends on what the Fed's going to do. And if there's signs that the Fed will react to a crisis with QE or getting rid of QT or stopping raising rates, yeah, stocks could fly from here. It's all about the Fed and liquidity. But everything you're asking comes down to inflation. What's inflation going to be? Is it going to be persistent? How quickly is it going to come down? Will it come down? And I think that's at the top of the Fed's mind right now, not how to deal with crises, but try to manage crises. Try to, you know, I think the Fed does want markets to come lower, but in a very controlled, stable manner. They don't like what happened Tuesday. They would rather grind lower over time and not create crises.
Right. So I'm gonna put you on the spot here, acknowledging that I'm just asking you to prognosticate. So Stephanie Pomboy just interviewed Jim Rickards for us, and he basically said, yeah, right now markets are expecting the Fed to engineer a soft landing. He says, I'm expecting it to be more like a plane crash. So my question for you is, what does your gut say? Will the Fed be able to do what it needs to do in order to get inflation effectively under control enough before it breaks something and has to reverse course? Or do you think the likelihood is that the Fed is forced to pivot before it's got inflation tamed, and then it re-exacerbates inflation as it goes back to tightening?
Right. I think a soft landing is unlikely. You know, how bad of a plane crash, I guess, is the question. And again, it comes down to inflation. You know, if inflation really starts dropping very quickly, they may even have a soft landing. They may be able to stop raising rates. I don't think they're going to drop them anytime soon, but at least calm the markets, calm consumers, calm corporations, and calm the dollar from appreciating, which would probably still have a recession, but not a hard crash. So I'm somewhere, I guess, between a soft landing and a disaster. But make no mistake, the situation of debt in this country and around the world make the thought of a crash landing, a really hard crash landing, that's in a realm of possibility. That's not a black swan. That's something that could happen because we've put ourselves in such a dire position, and inflation was that one fly in the ointment that could wreck everything. So that's what we're dealing with.
All right. So I'm just going to ask you one more time, and I have you back in the program to update things as they go on. But do you think the Fed is going to be able to tame inflation before it has to pivot, or do you think inflation is going to be a harder dragon to slay?
I think it's going to be a harder dragon to slay.
All right. Sorry for the pressure. Okay.
Just wanted to get there. You got it.
Mike Preston, let's go to you next. There's a lot in there to unpack. So, you know, any perspective you want to add to everything that Michael just said there?
Yeah, I know it sounds brutal, but I hope it's more of a crash than not. I mean, it's going to be hard for some people, but I think Iron Man in the comments there said, why is there even a Fed? You know, indeed, why is there a Fed? A group of people met on Jekyll Island and I forget if that's the name of the actual island, but it's the name of the book. It is. In 1913, you know, after the crash of the markets in 1907. And frankly, the Fed has been increasing their overreach ever since. Every crisis, their response has been more and more and more with no plan B. And it's created a lot of unfairness in the markets, and it's created a lot of unfairness in the real world. You know, the Fed can't print wealth. They can choose who gets the wealth. They can transfer the wealth. And frankly, it's caused a very, very unfair system. And we're now at a level where we need a permanently high plateau of overvalued markets because we can't handle even a little bit of pain. You know, and now, of course, as Michael just said, the fly in the ointment is inflation. They can't tame inflation without breaking markets. And Powell has to break markets to some extent to erase the idea that there's a Fed put. That's going to require some pain. There's nothing that's going to change without some kind of shock. And unfortunately, I think the Fed has built a system so fragile, so constantly in need of intervention at every turn, that it's likely that we're going to get some kind of crash. And I hate to use this analogy because, Adam, you said there was a small earthquake in Northern California yesterday, but it would have been a lot better to have a lot of small tremors versus one big giant earthquake. But I fear that that's what the Fed has likely created. And while nobody can predict the future, I think we're likely to get a much more severe crash, you know, to use that word. I know it sounds extreme, and that's what would give us, I think, some hope to see some regulation and some change going forward, because a lot of the freedom, frankly, maybe all of the freedom is gone in our modern markets.
Okay, I see you getting some thumbs up here from the folks in the live chat. John, let's go to you.
Yeah, I just want to pick up on Michael Leibowitz's comment that we totally agree with. Because of the amount of debt in the system, the Fed's ability to use interest rate increases alone as the tool to slay inflation is that much more constrained. And I think this adds to the notion that I spoke to earlier in response to the question about, is the Fed put likely to be removed or lowered? I think absolutely, given the trickiness of interest rate situations, given the debt load, that the Fed will likely use markets as their tool to let the markets drop more than they have been willing to do over the last several years. Because, you know, at the end of the day, some artificial wealth on a brokerage statement evaporating isn't going to be as damaging to the day-to-day functioning of the economy and debt markets as, you know, really high interest rates with such a leveraged system. And I think folks, you know, the reversal of the wealth effect that the Fed has so, strongly tried to create over the last decade, I think they're going to have to reverse that, you know, create the psychological fear in the markets to kind of do their heavy lifting. So just another key point that, you know, interest rates alone aren't going to be enough of a tool probably to deal with the inflation thing. And the markets can be, in this case, a helpful friend to the Fed in letting them deflate a bit. That's my personal opinion, what we're likely to see here in that defensive markets.
Okay. So I want to pull some more of these questions sort of about, you know, what could go wrong. And then I want to get to questions about, okay, what should we do about it? I'm going to do a riff off this question here, but the Fed is talking about that the Fed is really about to start quantitative tightening in earnest, right? That we're finally supposedly starting to see the full $95 billion come off of the Fed balance sheet on a monthly basis going forward. I interviewed Kyle Bass on this channel 2 weeks ago, and in his opinion, he thinks that that QT, full QT like this, is going to have more impact than the rate hikes. He thinks that's sort of a bigger club. So Mike Leibowitz, why don't I come to you for a second and just see, do you agree with that? And even if not, what impact do you think QT is going to have now that it's finally arriving in force?
I think they're both big clubs. And the benefit of QT is that it pulls liquidity from the financial markets. And I think that's why it's a big deal. And it may not show up immediately. You know, they've been doing QT for 3 or 4 months now, and they've been doing it at a rate that was equal to 2018, which ultimately caused problems before COVID, before we even knew what COVID was in mid-2019, which caused the Fed to ease and do QE with Treasury bills, if you remember. So I think they have these two clubs. Look, if they bring interest rates to 15% tomorrow, the economy will shut down, prices will drop like a rock, problem solved, at least the inflation problem solved. But at the same time, the stock market will drop as, you know, significantly as well. But you're dealing with kind of two different types of inflation. One is inflation for goods and services, and one is asset price inflation. So QT can help with the asset price inflation by pulling money, basically liquidity, out of the markets. That's what they're doing. They're trying to get some of this crazy sentiment out of the markets, let asset prices drop. And when people have less wealth, they spend less. They're not as confident. And I know the Fed doesn't want to say that out loud, but that's what they're doing. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to slow the economy. They tell you they're trying to slow the economy. And they truly believe that sentiment is a big deal for them. So there's consumer sentiment. How do we feel when we walk into a 7-Eleven? Are we willing to buy a bunch of things, or are we trying to cut back? But it's also, how do investors feel? How do you feel about your retirement savings? And almost everyone's an investor to some degree, whether it's retirement or whether it's cash. So they're trying to calm that sentiment down, which follows through to the economy.
All right. So let me just add on to that then. So that's what Powell has been saying for months when he says, look, you know, we can't control supply, but we can control the demand side. We're raising rates because we want to basically, you know, pump the brakes a bit. We want to make things a bit more expensive for people, especially, you know, who are using credit. And you just talked about how QT will drain out of the financial system, bring asset prices down, make investors feel that negative wealth effect. My question here, and it's peppered through some other folks' questions here too, which is, what's the danger of the Fed becoming a lot more successful at this than it's intending, right? In other words, that asset prices, financial asset prices come down more than it would, or come down faster and more sharply than it would like. But also, you know, these higher interest rates are already putting a dagger in the heart of the housing market, right? And as they go higher, they're going to make that housing market correct even harder. That's a much more widely owned asset amongst households than stocks are. So that's going to generate a pretty massive negative wealth effect. And then as corporate margins compress here, which I think everybody here on this, all three of you think is going to happen going forward, and, you know, consumer spending slows because the Fed's out there trying to bring demand down, where companies start laying people off. And there's nothing that dampens consumer spending than people being fearful of their jobs or having lost their actual income. So could we get to a point here where there's just a much bigger negative wealth effect than the Fed would hope for? Michael, I'll let you just give a quick answer to that, and then I'm going to come to you, John.
I'll be really quick this time. Yes.
Okay. All right, John, let's go to you.
Yeah, I think so. Look at the tech bubble collapse and the housing market collapse. Okay. Both of those were fueled by lower than normal or lower than healthy interest rates set by the Fed. And both of them were in part unraveled by the Fed having to put the brakes on their morphine to the markets. And the thing is, once markets started retreating in a meaningful way, they couldn't stop the flood. Look at what they did to interest rates in the collapse of the tech bubble and the housing bubble. They were lowering aggressively interest rates all the way down. And yet it didn't stop the free fall in markets. So bottom line is once the appetite for risk changes and the psychology changes, it's very hard for blunt things like lowering interest rates and all the tools the Fed has turned to over the last bunch of years to stem that tide. It takes a while to rebuild that psychology.
All right, Mike, feel free to add anything to that. I want to slip in this question here, so feel free to respond to this more if you'd like to. But since I just brought up housing, folks like Doug here are saying, what do y'all think is going to happen to the real estate market? He thinks it's in the process of breaking worldwide right now and the contagion will be severe. The big question is, how will that play out here? So I feel free to react to anything that Michael and John just said, Mike, but also how concerned are you about the housing market here? And at, you know, I don't even know what mortgages are at right now. Last time I saw, they were above 6%, which was more than double than where they were a year ago, August. You know, what are mortgage rates in that stratosphere or higher going to do to the housing market?
Yeah, I don't have too much more to say on the Fed. You know, the Fed is mostly what we talk about all the time in the financial markets, because that's what it's become. It's just become overbearing and, you know, involved in absolutely everything. And I think someday, and in the end, we'll look back and say, why did we believe them at all? I mean, look at their track record. They talked about trying to get to 2% inflation for what, 10 years? And inflation was lower than that. We just, no matter what they did, no matter how big the balance sheet got, nothing happened. And then all of a sudden we shot right to 9%. Right. And now they're talking about getting it down.
Sorry to interrupt, but I was in an interview yesterday where we pulled up a headline from June of 2021, where Powell was saying, I think it's very, very unlikely we're going to have any kind of inflation problem like we had in the 70s.
Yeah, we instantly go to 9%. And, you know, the data yesterday shows that it's pretty sticky. I think Michael earlier said that he expects it to go down to 4 or 5%, perhaps, and stay there for a while. Sorry if that's not correct, Michael, but you know that's kind of how we see it too, is that it's probably going to stay persistently higher. So the genie's out of the bottle. And, you know, in the end, it was all psychological, all of these tools. And there's real world ramifications because of that, like wealth disparity and other things. Like, for instance, we have a lot less tools to respond to crises now than we did before. We, you know, interest rates could cripple us based on the amount of debt that we have. So I know that we hang on literally every word because that's how the market is trained to be. But in the end, I think it will be found that they didn't really have that much to work with other than the same old thing, printing money. As far as the housing market, I don't really have a strong belief other than I saw in 2021, the housing market absolutely have a blow off top, just like every asset in 2021, meme stocks, crypto stocks, housing, collectibles, everything. Well, everything except precious metals, sadly, had a blow off top in 2021. We're already seeing the time on market increase, already seeing some price declines, but nothing big has happened yet in the housing market. I think we're close to a point where sellers are going to start to get a little worried and maybe rush to get on market properties that they don't otherwise want to hold, maybe second or third homes. And as was stated earlier, mortgages are inching up towards 7% again. I think the most likely thing, if I had to make a guess, is that we repeal the 2021 blow off top pretty quickly. And so that would be, you know, a decline of 20% or a little more than 20%. And late stage blow offs are usually recaptured pretty quickly. After that, I don't really have much of a viewpoint other than I think the housing market will probably hold in there better than the stock market. I wouldn't be surprised to see the stock market lose potentially 2/3 of its value before everything is said and done from the recent highs. And in the end, I don't think that housing will go down nearly as much, maybe 30% if I had to guess.
Okay. And just to that number, I interview Nick Gurley a lot about the housing market. He's actually going to be one of the featured speakers at the upcoming Wealthion conference in a week and a half. And he is very concerned about the housing market and obviously says it's going to differ. You know, your local mileage will vary in terms of how much your own market may correct. But sort of nationally, he's pegging about a 30% correction as well. All right. One last big macro thing before we get into, you know, okay, so how are you guys managing capital in an environment like this? Mike Leibowitz, let's come back to you. I've talked with a number of people about this on this channel, but I think it was Bill Fleckenstein who probably best described what's going on. One of the things that's different this time versus previous decades is there's been the rise in passive management, you know, these massive ETFs, right? And because they are formulaic, they basically, you know, have to hold certain stocks in a certain allocation. And because so much money is going into these ETFs, that forces the ETF's capital into oftentimes sort of the same stocks. So you've got this massive juggernaut. I think Bill calls it like a big mindless robot. But it's just going out there and shoving massive amounts of capital into, you know, the leaderboard stocks, the Apples, the Googles, the Amazons, et cetera. And in many ways that, you know, it's irregardless of what the fundamental story is telling. These funds just say, look, I got more money. I have to allocate it in this way. And so they can push up and support the prices of these stocks, even if the fundamentals in the macro environment don't support that. And so it's sort of, Bill was saying, look, this thing's kind of like a steamroller you don't want to stand in front of if it's headed your way. At the same time, he says, we got to remember too, that at some point, if those, you know, ETFs start having to, you know, the formulas are changed and they have to start, you know, selling down, this thing works the same way in reverse. It's going to be a very powerful reverse flood and could suck a ton of liquidity out of these, you know, these stocks that are propping up the indices right now. So how worried are you about this, Mike?
So first of all, that's something we, in our investment committee meetings, we talk about all the time. because it has and will affect the way we invest. So for instance, at the beginning of this year, we decided that not only were we going to reduce our stock exposure, but we were going to move to more value-oriented names. So within the world of value, there's large cap value, there's small cap value, and we went with more large cap value because those are in the big passive ETFs. If you buy the biggest of the value funds, it has massive corporations, regardless of whether they're value or not. You know, in a lot of cases, they're not really value companies, but you need to see how money is going to shift. And in the past, it was much, you know, 30 years ago, that was hard to do because everyone was an active investor and everyone had different opinions. Now, so much of the market is passive, meaning everyone, they may not have the same opinion, but they're investing the same way. So you have to watch the flows. And my biggest concern is that there are outflows from passive funds. Either, you know, people finally get scared and they move to the money markets, to cash, or they move to bonds and out of stocks, or people cut their contributions to their 401ks, or older people start withdrawing money at a faster rate because of inflation, because of losses in the market. Regardless of what it is, when those flows start flipping and those monthly flows start becoming negative, it does. Like you said, Adam, it has the opposite effect. And it's just a headwind to the markets, which will push it lower. So I think for investors, it is very important to always have that passive mindset on. And you can find the most, you know, past 10 years, the most valuable stocks were going nowhere because no one was investing in them. The benefit of those stocks that are not in passive funds is that they don't get dragged along by the market. Now, that was a negative thing when markets were going up, but that can be a very positive thing when markets are going down.
That is a fascinating point. And your partner, Lance Roberts, you know, has said that, you know, up till now, investors have used stocks like Microsoft and Apple as a place to hide. That's the way that Lance says it, which is, you know, you're parking capital because you can feel pretty, you've been able to feel confident that, you know, those stocks aren't going to go down dramatically because they're being propped up by this massive juggernaut. Of course, they could turn into the Roach Motels of the future, you know, when this all reverses. You know, I'm sort of making your guys' case here for you, but a lot of other people I've interviewed here recently have as well, which is passive management has worked really well. It's probably likely not going to work super well going forward. Active management is going to become a lot more important. And to your point there, Michael, like the fundamentally good companies haven't really benefited the way they should have over the past decade. They got overlooked because capital just wasn't going into them. That may very well reverse here. And, you know, being able to pick quality companies may actually be like a real life raft going forward. John, let me head to you here.
Yeah, I just want to absolutely correct the steamroller effect on the way up works in reverse too. And let me just, by way of example, give a poignant example of that. When the psychology changes, it's everything. Going back to 2009, I know it's ancient history, when the market was near the bottom of its implosion after the housing bust, my partner Mike and I were witnessing on some peer discussion boards that we were plugged into, peer other advisors. These were advisors that were generally dyed in the wall, buy and hold, never sell, always be invested. They were having fervent debates about, hey, maybe we should start dollar cost averaging out of the markets. These are the most steadfast, dyed in the wool, buy and hold folks wanting to sell, rationalize selling out of the market, what in hindsight was near the lows. So that psychology, when it changes, can absolutely reverse that easy come, easy go mentality in these passive funds. It can work just as viciously on the downside as it has in the melt up higher.
All right, great. Mike, I'm coming to you real quickly before we do. Just want to remind folks, if you are enjoying this format, this monthly, you know, live Q&A format, do me a favor, just let me know in the live chat if you want to see us keep doing this going forward. I think folks are enjoying this, but it's always great to hear validation of that. Or if you want something else, again, let us know. We listen very hard. Also, I want to pat myself on the back. I think I've finally actually kind of got the hang of this new software that we use here. I haven't screwed up too dramatically yet. Now, I'm sure I'm going to, now that I've just said that. All right, Mike, anything else you want to add to what Mike Leibowitz and John have just said there about, you know, trying not to become collateral damage to this massive juggernaut?
No, just seconding what John just said, that when capitulation occurs in true bear markets, it's something to behold. That 2008 low, we didn't even really get to an undervalued state. The Shiller price earnings ratio bottomed at somewhere around 15, if I remember correctly. Previous bear markets bottomed around 6, 7, or 8. The only reason we bottomed back in 2008 was because mark-to-market accounting was repealed. You know, and the very day that was repealed, the market took off. But it could have been a lot worse. And yes, psychologically, that's about as severe as anything anyone's ever been through. But if this is a real true bear market, and you had a guest on recently that was talking about this, I think it was Coakley, if I remember correctly. Please feel free to. Ted Oakley, sorry. He was talking about a true bear market and what that's like, and that he believes that we're in a true bear market now. We agree. And if that's the case, defense is going to be important. Don't underestimate your ability to hold on passively through a true bear market. So, you know, we'd say review allocations, review exposure to risk, reduce it if possible, and don't be too quick to buy the dips.
All right. So, Mike, you're heading right into the territory I want to get into now, which is, okay, so look, what do we do about this as investors, right? You guys have just outlaid a pretty grim macro picture here. And seems like many of you feel, or all of you feel, that the downside risks are serious. And so you obviously want to have a strategy to defend against them. I'm not hearing from many of you or any of you like a massively long case for the markets in general, or necessarily for any particular asset class, though if that's untrue, please let me know. So we have a question here. This is pretty specific. And Mike Leibowitz, maybe the question I'll ask you is just, how are you positioning for this type of environment right now? Feels very highly uncertain, but you guys have a lot of client capital that you've got to, you know, take care of. So how are you guys looking at investing for the future, given the macro view you just shared with us? And maybe Right. Specifically in your answer, you can talk about shorting. This fellow here is saying, hey, how do you feel about holding SQQQ, which is the short NASDAQ ETF?
Yeah, so let me just start with the SQQQ. It's tough holding for long periods of time the ETFs, the short ETFs. Just because of the math behind them, you're most likely not going to, you know, even if you're right and the market drops 20%, it's really difficult to harvest that 20%, especially if it goes down in wiggles, it goes up and down and up and down and ends up down 20%. You're likely going to end up with a gain far short of 20% like you should get. So I would just say be careful with ETFs. As far as we're positioned, and since January 1st, we have been reducing exposure, reducing our beta, moving to more value dividend-oriented stocks that have, and some of them, a lot of them are actually up on the year, that have really outperformed. And the reason we started on January 1st is because that's when the Fed was telling us that the liquidity heyday was coming to an end. And we're following the same path today that we're following then. We're very concerned about our risk exposure, both in stocks and bonds. We hold on to a lot of cash in both parts of both the stock and the bond portfolio. And I really don't see a situation where we get back up to where our model states that we should be in both equities or bonds at this point. It's a difficult environment. The Fed is pulling liquidity. And we have inflation the likes we haven't seen in most of our careers. We haven't seen inflation like that. You know, last time I saw inflation like that, I was a kid. So it's a very difficult environment. And I think the more cash you can, and you know, cash yields almost 4% now. That's not, I know it's below the rate of inflation, but it's not awful anymore. It's not zero. So, you know, I think the more money you can hold on to and buy when ultimately stocks bottom out, the more wealth you can preserve and ultimately put yourself in a much better position to retire early, hopefully.
Okay. So just to restate a little bit what you said at the end there, time to be defensive and time to maybe accumulate dry powder so that at some point when this all plays out, you're positioned to then deploy at better valuations?
Yeah, look, yes. But also keep in mind, if you're very, you know, depending on where you are on the risk scale, you know, if you're willing to take a lot of risk, short the market, buy puts. There's other, you know, all kinds of strategies. If you're very conservative, just move to cash. You know, get in much more defensive companies, ones with stocks that aren't nearly as volatile. So the question's a tough question because every client is somewhere different on that spectrum. But the bottom line is, I think defense will pay for the, you know, certainly the foreseeable future.
Okay. And John Lodera, I know you guys at New Harbor, cash is quite a big position for you guys. So I got to imagine that you're like-minded with Mike on that. Well, let me just ask the general question of you. How are you guys at New Harbor positioning for this environment that we've all been talking about here?
Yeah, absolutely. Defensive, in a word, and holding very high, relatively high cash balances. You know, we have a lot of tools to hedge. You know, the gentleman that asked the question asked in the context, I think, of taking a short position, a net short position, which certainly from a fundamental standpoint could be rationalized. We generally don't take net short positions for our clients on a discretionary basis. We have some that would like to request us to do so, and we can talk to them about how to do that and the pros and cons. But we do a lot of hedging. We have a lot of tools for hedging. But I want to be very clear. The cheapest form of hedging, or the cheapest form of insurance, if you will, on a investment portfolio in these elevated times is to simply be out of the market by holding high cash balances. There's always some cost to hedging, just like there's a cost to having insurance on your house. Sometimes the cheapest form of defensiveness is just holding cash. And like Michael Leibowitz pointed out, cash is yielding something of note, certainly a competitive yield compared to other asset classes, whether it's the S&P 500 and the dividend yield there, but the significant for dramatic downside. So yeah, right here and now, and to be heavily defensive, light equity allocations, light bond allocations, heavy weighted towards shorter term cash like investments like treasury bills, things like that, waiting patiently for better opportunities. And Mike Preston, my partner, cautioned, and I want to reiterate, I think it's going to be important not to to resist the temptation to kind of think that every pullback is a green light to get, you know, fully reinvested. I think we're likely in a long, drawn out struggle here that we'll likely see fits and starts, you know, declines followed by some bounces, followed by deeper declines. We think we're in a different character market, and patience and discipline is likely to be very important.
All right, Mike Preston, there are a number of questions here about that relate in some way, shape, or form to hard assets. So, you know, we're in this strange environment, I guess probably stagflationary environment is the best way to say it, right? Where we're having all of these risks of, you know, economic growth continuing to slow, tightening, negative wealth effect, et cetera. But we are still seeing massive inflation or very hot inflation in the essentials for living, right? And, you know, as Mike said, you know, we're cheering a 4% return on cash, which, by the way, for folks asking, Mike, I think you were talking about, you get that return by investing in short-term U.S. treasuries, right?
Yeah, and I may have gone ahead a little bit, but they're going to be 4% over the next few months as the Fed 3+ brings up rates. Right.
Yeah.
So I apologize for all those comments. People looking for 4%. You're gonna have to wait a couple months.
Yeah, but it's actually worth just railing for a second here. One of the things that really just gets me is, you know, the Fed funds rate is now what, at like 2.25-ish, 2.5, and it's going to be above 3 if we were to believe the Fed at its next meeting. And and yet banks are still paying like 0.06% interest on your cash. While they're happy to lend to you, you know, especially if you're like a credit card holder of theirs, you know, above 17%, right? So, you know, people are still getting starved of safe return on their cash and a lot of conventional vehicles. I mean, thankfully, those that know how to go buy treasuries directly themselves via Treasury Direct or some of the other solutions out there, you now can start getting, you know, a better rate. But it's just criminal how the banks are just, you know, continuing to starve people of, you know, what should be a rightful return. That's my opinion.
Real quick, Adam, you don't have to buy treasuries. There's like ETFs like BIL that buys treasury bills and they charge a very low fee and you get basically the same effect. So there are alternatives other than buying bonds.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that clarification. All right. So Mike Preston, getting back to you though. So, you know, I kind of gave that stagflationary backdrop because people are saying, well, look, you know, okay, I guess I'm hearing you guys tell me I should put my money into cash, but I'm worried, you know, holding on to cash in an environment where inflation is still, you know, at 8.3%. And who knows how long it's going to take for the Fed to bring that down from here. So a lot of people understandably are saying, you know, well, should I be putting money in hard assets then? Assets that historically have preserved purchasing power much better in the future. A lot of questions here about gold and silver, which I know that you guys take positions in. So what's your guys' current outlook and level of confidence in hard assets? Let me also maybe, if you can, in your answer, address the fact that, you know, in some ways we've had the conditions that gold bugs have been dreaming of for years, and yet the precious metals haven't really performed the way that folks would like.
Yeah, it has been frustrating. I mentioned earlier that 2021 was a blow-off top year for almost everything except precious metals. And I really can't explain why, other than stepping back and looking at the charts over a very long period. If you look at the gold chart on a monthly basis going back to 2000, actually performed pretty well over that entire period of time. Now, the problem is most people didn't own it over the entire period of time. In gold, since the 2011 top, has been a very disappointing, long, drawn-out correction, a bear market. Recently, it had a breakout and then created this big triangle that I've been mentioning sometimes on the weekly videos. We broke out of that triangle, hit about 2,100, and then came right back down to that 1,680 or so critical support level. Right now, as I speak, gold is at around 1713. So it's really languishing towards the bottom end of that trading range. But I really think it's you know, technically it's still sound. It's a little bit shaky, but to me that bullish triangle still looks intact. You have to understand that we've been fighting a soaring dollar this year. And in general, short term, a strong dollar is bad for the price of gold in dollars. Just looking at a chart of the dollar this year, it's up about 15%. So the whole Brent Johnson dollar milkshake theory is playing out so far and may play out a little bit longer. But to me, the dollar looks technically extended here. And gold and silver, with all of this madness and this crazy psychological, you know, kind of game that's going on with the Fed, it seems to us like one of the few ways that you can buy something real that's outside of all of that. So when we look at real assets, particularly gold and silver, because they're easier to buy, as one way to just leave the party, at least with part of your assets. So our recommendation is somewhere around 10% of investable assets in gold and silver, maybe 2/3 gold or 3/4 gold, 1/4 silver, ideally delivered to you and held close by so you can get to it if you need it. I see in the comments there's some talk about silver coins at $29 or $30. It's true. The American Eagle silver coins have ridiculous premiums on them right now. The American Gold Eagles have large premiums. Strongly suggest for people looking to buy 1 ounce coins that they think about looking at the Canadian Maple Leaf or the South African Kruger Rand. They're much more reasonable right now, both for gold and silver coins. So big believers, around 10% is just about right. Look at the coins other than the American coins. And lastly, don't forget mining stocks. We like both mining stocks and bullion. Mining stocks should participate in a leveraged fashion to the upside, and they're very, very extremely undervalued here and oversold, I might add.
All right. One thing I want to just note for folks, since you mentioned it there, premiums are really high right now on physical bullion coins in particular. If you go to wealthion.com/gold-silver, I think it's gold silver, or it's wealthion.com/GS, you'll be directed to goldsilver.com, and there's a bit of a coupon you get by following that URL, which is why I mention it. But they have a program there called InstaVault, where basically you are able to buy a fractional ownership of these, you know, massive 1,000-ounce bars, silver bars. And so it's by far the way to buy physical bullion with the lowest premiums that are out there. The premium that you're charged is really just a small fraction of what's being charged on coins right now. So if you just care about getting exposure to physical bullion, and you literally own your fraction of that bar, it's allocated to you in your name. It's a great way to again get exposure to the actual physical metal at the lowest premium to spot. All right, Mike Leibowitz, let me come to you here. Again, just want to get your thoughts on, you know, exposure to hard assets right now. Very understandable given the high inflationary environment, but certainly seeing the number of comments that are here, a lot of people are looking at this space quite closely.
So we do own a little bit of gold in our portfolios. Doesn't sound like we have as much as the New Harbor guys. But one of the things that we kind of watch, and I like having gold for the long run, but in the short run, one of the things that we watch closely is the strong correlation between gold and real yields. Real yields are just the treasury yields minus expected inflation. And what they tell you is, I think in a nutshell, what it really tells you is how aggressive is the Federal Reserve with either easy money or hawkish money. So for the better part of the last 20 years, we've seen real yields being negative. In other words, anyone that's buying a treasury bond should expect to lose purchasing power over time. Real yields for the first time in a while are now positive. That tells me that the Fed is being hawkish, that the Fed is doing their job. And one of my concerns with gold over the next few months, at least, is that the Fed is going to continue to do their job, that they are going to pull liquidity out of the system, that they are going to pop bubbles, that they are going to do kind of what they should be doing. And so that's one of our hesitations towards gold in the short run. In the long run, I agree. Gold is kind of one of those things you should have. Store it away, put it away, and stop looking at the price every day. It's a great insurance policy.
Hey, Mike, could I just ask, so your concern in the short term, because the Fed is going to do what it needs to do, is it that you think it's going to engineer a market downdraft, and as margin calls come in, collateral that retains its value gets sold, and that's why the gold price is going to go down? We've seen that happen in the past. Fed is raising interest rates, which means the real interest rate is becoming less negative, which people think is gold negative.
Yes and yes. You know, as we saw in 2008, people have to sell what's liquid. If you go back to 2008, the subprime mortgages that were selling were the AAA ones, not the junky ones, the AAA ones that were going to be fine because that's what people could sell. There was no market for the junk. And that holds true across the spectrum. It's very easy to sell a gold ETF. It's very easy to sell ETFs. So when people need liquidity to meet margin calls or just to get out of the market, they sell what they can sell. The bigger concern, though, is just the correlation that we've seen between gold prices and real yields. And real yields are ticking up. And as long as inflation expectations become anchored, in part because the Fed is promising to keep raising rates and to keep rates higher. Yeah, I think it's a tough slog for gold for the next potentially few months. Again, though, in the longer run, this is potentially a bump in the road. This isn't a big deal. But if you're trading gold, it may be time to be a little careful here. But if we start getting indications the Fed's willing to take their foot off their brake, that there's financial instability, sure, we could see some good flows into gold and silver.
Okay. Well, as we begin to wrap up here, guys, first, thanks so much. We've just passed the hour here, so I'm going to have to start wrapping up. Let me just ask you guys, John, I'll start with you, and then we'll go back to you, Mike. Can you guys just share generally how your firms have performed this year versus the general markets?
Yeah, I think I can give you, you know, we have to be very careful to give specific results, strong regulatory confines of what we need to be bound by. But our clients are down a little bit on the year on average. Most clients are pretty, you know, similarly invested with our guidance. Some decide they want to be either more or less in equities or other things, and that's fine. We can accommodate that and have different strategies for doing that. But very low single digit downside for you know, most of our core clients. Certainly on a relative basis this year, doing better than a traditional kind of 60-40 type of allocation. And, you know, we hate taking victory laps. Nothing about being down at all is a victory. You know, we're in this for the long haul. We very much know that keeping score by the month or the day or even the year is not really the way to manage one's finances over their lifetime. Because really what matters is, how can this money be your slave and not the other way around? How can this money allow you to live the life you want to live that you've worked hard to accumulate? And that's really what we want to do. And we do that through education perspective and decisiveness, frankly, giving clients clear, objective viewpoints on where the markets are and what it likely means for pros and, you know, upsides and downsides. That's really what our job is to do.
Okay. And the reason why I asked this question is, you know, both of your firms are, you know, I would say are data-driven, and I'll say skeptical of today's markets, and not that you guys are bearish by philosophy, but that you've listed a lot of reasons why you were concerned about the high valuations the markets attained at the end of last year. And it seems like your approach, and we're going to hear from you, Michael, in just a second. But it seems like your approach has let you outperform the market. So, John, you just said, you know, on average, your clients are maybe down a few percentage points. That's compared to the S&P, which I haven't run the numbers today, but I'm sure after yesterday's decline, it's down somewhere between 15 and 20% for the year at this point. Okay. So I'm just curious, Mike Leibowitz, how are things faring at RIA?
Sounds similar. We are down single digits. You know, like you said, stocks and bonds are both down, call it 15, 20% for the year. And we compare ourselves against that. But we, you know, we have a lot of clients and a lot of different types of portfolios. Some portfolios are more risky, some are more conservative. But, you know, our goal this whole year has been to reduce risk, to limit our losses. We still do have some losses, but, you know, part of what we're doing is, it's important to have the gains when the market's up, and it's a two-sided market, and you have to be involved. If you're not involved, you're going to miss out on the upside. You may miss out on the downside, but at the end of the day, you're worse off. So we are greatly trying to limit our losses through this environment. At times we have used short hedges. We've used a lot of cash, and we will likely continue to do that and try to keep our losses to a minimum, and certainly much better than what we potentially see the market performing.
All right. Thanks, guys. All right. Well, look, a few last things before I let each of you give your parting bits of advice to today's investors. Let me just put up this URL on the screen. I want to remind folks of the upcoming conference. That's just a week and a half away. We do this fall conference every year. This year is looking absolutely to be our best one yet in terms of talent. We have former senior Federal Reserve economist Lacey Hunt, who's going to go deep into where he sees Fed policy going from here. And as we've been talking about, that seems to be the axis that the markets and the global economy are pivoting around right now, for better or worse. We're going to have Lynn Alden delivering her macro market outlook. We'll also get macro outlooks from Grant Williams, Stephanie Pomboy. We'll have Matt Taibbi there talking about both Wall Street and media capture. He's seeing a lot of the same abuses and risk factors that he saw when he was covering the 2008 global financial crisis. That's going to be a fascinating conversation. We'll have Nick Jurley talking about the housing market that I mentioned. We'll have Alf Pecatiello, who's a bond market expert, talking about the bond market and what it's telling us right now. We'll have Doomberg talking about the global energy crisis and what he sees going forward ahead and the impact that will have on markets and the opportunities that that's making available to investors today. We'll have Rick Rule talking about the whole scope of hard assets. We'll have Mike Maloney talking about the precious metals. We'll have Jeff Clark talking about mining stocks. And we're going to have our financial advisors, the folks you see here, they're the whole day, and we'll end the day with another live Q&A like this, where you guys can ask any questions you like about anything the speakers talked about, or any particular personal question that you might have about your own household's personal financial situation. There's no question too big or too small for that end of the day. So if you haven't yet registered, go to the Wealthion.com conference URL you see here at the bottom of the screen. And make sure you do that now so you capture the remaining 15% price discount. All right. Also, if you have not yet had a free personal financial consultation with these gentlemen here, just go to Wealthion.com and fill out the short form there. Hopefully you've gotten from this conversation, folks, that this is a really tough time for the average investor to navigate and protect their wealth. And if you do not have a good coach, you know, basically helping you navigate all this, there's no reason why you shouldn't have one. In fact, that might be what makes the difference for capital going forward. So there's no commitment for this. It doesn't cost you anything. There are no strings attached. These guys just do it as a public service. They'll sit down with you. They'll hear your personal financial situation. They'll tell you what they think you should do. And you can take that information and act on it yourself. You can act on it with your existing financial advisor. Or if you like these guys, you can keep talking with them if you want to. But again, to do that, just go to Wealthion.com, fill out the short form there. All right. Well, as we wrap things up, let's start with you, Mike Preston. What's your parting bits of advice for folks that are leaving this live event here and having to make decisions about what to do with their money from here?
Well, I hate to be the doomer in the group, but, you know, I think this is a real bear market. I think we all agree with that. And it just feels to me like it's going to be more severe just because of how far it's been pushed and how extreme it's been for all of these years. And so I think that surprises are likely to be to the downside. So I take the advice that we talked about in this program, reduce equity exposure. I'd recommend below 30%, raise some cash so that you can buy things at a cheaper price, own some gold and silver, and just wait, you know, have some liquidity and wait. And over the next 1 or 2 years, you should have a lot more opportunity, in my opinion, in both stocks and in real estate. So I'd like to say we at New Harbor are actually optimists, but it's been so long that the market's been allowed to be free and have a real true correction that it feels like now for over 10 years, a good part of our career, maybe almost 20 years, the market has been, you know, dealing with this permanent intervention. And we frankly think that's ending. So just be careful. Surprises are likely to be to the downside, in our opinion.
Okay. Well said. And as Ken D just said here, don't buy the dip, buy the train wreck. So, all right, wait for things to clear. All right. We'll stick with New Harbor. John, why don't we go to you?
Yeah, I really don't have anything to add. You know, Mike and I, as partners and core leaders of our investment committee, we're on the same page. So I really have not much to add. I just want to thank everybody for the time today and really appreciated the conversation. And thank you, Michael Leibowitz, for your great comments.
Thanks. All right. Well, Mike, you get the bat cleanup here.
Don't fight the Fed. Everyone understood what don't fight the Fed meant in 2020, most of 2020 and 2021. It meant just go along, don't fight them. When the Fed's buying bonds, buy stocks. Well, don't fight the Fed also means don't fight them the other way around. The Fed seems intent on raising rates, on doing QT. Don't fight it. Don't fight it. They're pulling liquidity out of the markets, and that never ends well. So, like you said, buy the train wreck.
All right. Well, wise words. And it's crazy there, Mike, that, you know, so many people just love to repeat that mantra when the markets were going up, when the Fed put was in place. Hey, don't fight the Fed. Just go along for the ride, buy the dips, you know, whatever. And the market has had a really hard time following its own advice here as the Fed has been headed in the other direction, right? And what we may be seeing, you know, finally, is a bit of capitulation. That's what yesterday might have been, you know, an initial, you know, development of the market saying, ah, you know what, we may actually have to follow our own advice here. Seems like, you know, we haven't seen the full capitulation that we expect here yet, but very wise words. If you shouldn't have fought it on the way up, you shouldn't fight it on the way down. All right, look, everybody, thanks so much for watching. Again, if you'd like to see this format continue, we'll plan to do it on a monthly basis. But again, let us know in the comments section what you think. We listen very closely. My esteemed guests here, guys, thanks so much for taking an hour and 15 minutes out of your busy days, especially after such a extreme day in the market yesterday. So thanks so much for sharing your insights and wisdom with us. Everybody else, thanks so much for joining us and thanks for watching.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.